Okay, so today is the 21st of May 2025, and my name is Nicholas Labigra, and I'm interviewing Jill McWilliam. Jill McWilliam has donated a substantial number of videos to the Alfonston Institute Archives, and this interview or discussion is really just to contextualize that collection a wee bit and give Jill a chance to tell us what it's all about. So my first question for you, Jill, and it's one that I ask everybody that I ever interview, is can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who are you? Where are you from?
Well, I'm living at Cruden Bay at the moment. I'm originally from the parish of Slains, from a farm. So I'm a farm quine, really. So I suppose that's where my Doric roots started when I was working and living on the farm with my dad. I moved away to Inverness for 10 years and then down to Fife. Come back to this area, not to the same parish, Slains, but I came back to Cruden Bay. I came back with a bit of a vengeance. After coming from the Highlands, I couldn't see the beauty in the Northeast, because to me it was grey. There was grey granite, there was grey seagulls, there was, you know, it's grey clouds. And that's what I could see, because I loved the Highlands. So then I thought to myself, I'm going to have to do something about this. I'm going to have to change the way that I look at it. And I did that through looking through my camera, my cell camera, and then my video camera.
That's really interesting. When did you come back to the area?
20 years ago, Nick.
Right, okay. Mm. That's really quite interesting. I mean, you mentioned Slains, you mentioned Cruden Bay. For people who maybe don't know that, they're pretty close to each other, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. Next door.
And so, I mean, that's really interesting that you went away and you came back and you had to sort of push yourself to find the beauty again. I like that notion, because I think a lot of people experience that in different ways, in different places, not specific to the Northeast necessarily. But now that you have sort of reawoken to the beauty and wonders of the Northeast and of Cruden Bay and Slains and all of that, what makes it so special, do you think?
The people. We're in a unique position, because where I live, especially, we jut out into the North Sea, and we are the most northeasterly point in Scotland, so it makes it quite unusual. Unusual people, because if you look at our background, we're primarily farming and fishing, and that's really what got me excited, really, was to look back in our culture, where we'd come from, what makes us tick, and how we are now, comparing ourselves to the past.
Oh, that's really interesting. So where are we now compared to the past? How do we connect to the past of the Northeast? Obviously, you've got people like me, we speak very differently. I've come from elsewhere, and now I'm in the Northeast. How do we connect all these different things that have changed in the Northeast to all those things like the farming traditions, the fishing traditions, and everything else that you're so connected to?
Well, I think they're connecting very well. I mean, people who come to this area, I think, are genuinely interested in where we've been in the past. And I think that we have changed tremendously, and I think that change has been good, because one has encompassed the other. I think that, you know, change as the oil, I think, has brought a lot of change to this area. It's the biggest change that I've ever seen in my lifetime, and I think in the lifetime of the Northeast, is oil. As I say, basically, this area used to be farming and fishing predominantly, and then oil came and it changed the whole game altogether. And then we've got lots of people coming from lots of areas, and I thought that was a good reason, another reason really, to maybe document where we are in the here and now, how change was being encompassed, but trying to sort of push the idea that we mustn't forget about our past and our Doric language as well.
Yeah, that's everything you're saying is just so interesting. There's so many different levels to it. A lot of people, when they're interested in their own culture, not all of them obviously, but a lot of them look backwards and they look at the past, and they focus on the traditions of the past and things like that. But to me, it sounds like you're really interested in looking at what's here now, Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think that's why the platform that I created, the Druidic Future, the YouTube channel primarily, and then the website, the Druidic Future, I think that was why really it was created, is to grasp who and what we are now in the Northeast. Because I couldn't rewind the tape, because I've got no tape to rewind of the past. I wished that I'd videoed younger, when I was younger, but I didn't. So the only thing I could do was to go out and video what was round about me and who was round about me in the here and now to present to the future.
Right, that's interesting. So in a way, this is, you're sort of framing this as something that will be of benefit to people in later generations, for example?
I hope so. I do hope so. Yeah, because that was one of the reasons that I thought about doing video work extensively, was to think of all the older people, especially that I videoed, and the skills that they still retained. I thought that was very important to video, so that could be passed on to the future, and we could learn from that, future generations.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, when you're away from a place, And I know this, I haven't been back home in ages, actually, 12 years, I think. But I remember the last time I went back home, and it had been ages since I'd been back home even then, I was sort of flabbergasted by the changes and almost overwhelmed. I couldn't quite process it. And I wonder how it felt for you to come back. I mean, you've touched on that a wee bit, but Through your work, were you surprised by anything that you found through all the people that you met and interviewed and documented?
Yeah, there was still a great enthusiasm for retaining our culture and language. Everybody that I interviewed was so excited about being interviewed, especially by a local lass. So that to me was, you know, it was good for me, because I thought this was a worthwhile thing that I was doing, Nick. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's interesting. I like the idea of it being a worthwhile thing, I guess. And, you know, I mean, you and I both know what it feels like to be on the other side of the microphone, as it were. And I'm sorry to put you on the receiving end today, which maybe feels a bit unusual. But I guess I'm just wondering if, you know, if people are, how are they expressing their interest in it? How are they saying that they were quite keen to take part and all of that? You're saying that it felt like people were quite thankful to be interviewed by you. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, I think they expressed themselves in different ways. One man from Whinnyfold, or as it's known commonly as Funny Fowl, he just wanted to present himself as he was in a shed in Funny Fowl. And that was great. Nothing, in fact, none of my videos are rehearsed. They're all just off the cuff. And I thought that was nice, that he just was so keen to be somebody taking notice of him. I just thought that was great. Sorry, Nick.
No, you're okay. It doesn't matter. You don't need to mime anything. It's just a wee discussion. But no, it was just how people sort of express their interest or their gratitude.
Yeah. Through their music, mm-hmm. Their skills. Their skills, Nick. What they made with their hands. Fishermen, farming, and music, these sort of things, they were able to present themselves through that. Because a lot of people from this area, like myself, don't like normally to speak. We would rather shy away and not be seen at all, believe it or not. But I think catching them in their natural environment and doing what they love doing best. And I met a lot of interesting people doing interesting things, and they were just so keen to share that.
There's that idea in the Northeast that people are sometimes backwards at putting themselves forward.
Mm.
And it's interesting for me to hear you sort of describe yourself like that, because to me you're quite gregarious and outgoing. Did you have to push yourself to be like that, in a sense, for your projects and for your videos?
Yeah, you definitely have to push yourself. And if you didn't love doing it, you couldn't do it. because, you know, I work on my own, and the only help and assistance that I got was a chap in the village who created the website for me, the Druidic Future website. And he presented material into the website because I couldn't do that. So I did it all on my own. So therefore, if I didn't have the love of doing it, I couldn't do it, because I would be too, I'd be too shy, too hiding in the background, thinking I'm not of worth, because a lot of us in the Northeast, that's what we think. That's how, what holds us back, I think. But if you've got a, if you've got a passion or something to run with, I think that's what made me go forward, Nick.
That's interesting, and it kind of connects back to what you were saying earlier, and that idea of, I mean, people think of the Highlands. I mean, I know that tourists will come, and they'll go to Edinburgh, they'll go to Inverness, they'll maybe go to Skye. Often they'll sort of miss out the Northeast. And I think, would you agree that sometimes there's a kind of a, almost like a lack of confidence, or in the value of the Northeast, or in the value of the area in some people? Like, they think compared to other parts of Scotland, it's maybe not as beautiful or not as interesting in some ways, or...
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons that I created the Druidic Future YouTube channel and the website, was really to try to help raise our profile and to say, look, we're here. We're as good as anybody else in Scotland and anywhere else in Scotland, you know. And I, that's really one of the driving forces for me, really, was to have a platform that we could be seen and that we could be reckoned with.
Yeah, well, fair enough. I think you've done an astonishing job at doing that. I guess let me pull back a wee bit and ask a bit more about the project. And I'm going to slightly lower the levels. Okay, I think that should maybe be a wee bit better. But yeah, in terms of the project, you've come back from the Highlands. I'm just trying to situate it. You come back to from the Highlands 20 years ago. You come back to the area. When did the first idea of doing this come to mind?
Well, I started photographing the area intensely, especially up at Slane's Castle. And I entered NEOS a couple of times, which I thought was very good, because I'm not really a photographer, just an image maker. And I think there, from my walks up to Slane's Castle, grew an interest in a character. Well, it's not a character, he's a real life character, and that's Bram Stoker, the writer of the Dracula story. And that really got me started, a foothold, because I had a first project for videoing. And it was a foothold, and I thought it was a big foothold, because there wasn't really, I mean, it was sort of banded about in the background, very far background, about Bram Stoker's connection with Croon Bay and Bram Stoker. And when I thought deeply, more and more and deeply about it, I thought, well, what brought Bram Stoker up from London? He was the manager of the Lyceum Theatre in London. What brought him up and his family to this area? What caught his imagination to the extent that he went and wrote the Dracula story? So I intently followed in his footsteps. I rambled up and down the cliff tops of Cruden and Slane's, and I produced material, visual material, to try to visually interpret what I thought was maybe going through his mind, guessing why he produced what he did. And that went down very well, actually, was the forerunner to what we see now of Cruden Bay as actually being a step up in the tourist map for Bram Stoker, because there is a plaque outside the Kilmarnock Arms Hotel with Bram Stoker's name on it. And there was a connection made between Cruden Bay and Canada, and Bram Stoker's great-grand-nephew, Dacre Stoker, came over to Cruden Bay to meet in with the locals there. So, yeah, it just shows you the power of what the mind can produce. And that came from nowhere, just me walking along the cliff line up at Slane's Castle.
That's amazing. I didn't actually realise that you'd been a photographer as well. Did you do anything with the materials exhibits or anything like that, or show them to other people?
I exhibited my photographs as where I could exhibit them locally. And as I said, in two separate years, I entered NEOS and opened my house in Port Erroll to anybody that wanted to see the local area on print. So yes, it was a good experience.
What kinds of people were interested in the photos? Was it outsiders? Was it locals? A bit of both?
It was a bit of both, Yeah, a bit of both. But I think, again, you look at this area and you think, gosh, there's a lot of talented people in this area. And I thought, well, I really wanted to throw up my door and say, come on, look, we are here. And there is a lot of talent about this area. And it's slow, but I can see changes in the Buchan area. Yeah.
You mentioned that plaque in front of the Kilmarnock Arms, I think you called it. Were you involved in that at all?
In the background I was, Nick. It was my neighbour who got the enthusiasm from seeing the material that I'd made. I was in the background, I was. But it was Mike Shepherd who was the forerunner to all the connections with Dacre Stoker.
Right, okay, that's interesting. And of course, Mike has written a book now all about that and gave us a really interesting talk last year. Did you come to that talk?
No,
that's okay. just trying to remember. It was a great talk, really interesting. And I do have I think I've got a recording of it if you're interested in watching it. But I'm sure you've heard Mike go on and on about that previously anyway. So I'm just trying to think chronologically here, and we're at a situation where you've started doing photographs, you start exhibiting them at NEOS a couple of times, you get different people to come and see the photographs, you get some enthusiasm about the local area, and then what followed after that?
Video. The video camera.
How soon after?
It wasn't all that long, Nick, because I'd had a video camera up in Inverness, but I didn't do anything specifically with it. But I think what helped me tremendously when I went to the Apple shop and got an iPhone, especially for videographers. It was the best phone I could get that were for videographers, and I'm non-technical. But it was good because it was easy to operate. Just a little camera, not a lot of gadgets. So that was me. I just ran with it, basically.
That's interesting. And what did you start? Because obviously before it sounds like you were taking photographs of places as opposed to people. Is that true?
Yeah.
So suddenly you shift from taking photos of places and landscapes and sites and things like that, and you start videoing people, or were you videoing landscapes? What kinds of things did you start videoing?
Well, in the year, well, we all remember the year 2020, obviously. Gosh. What I did there was quite unique. As a videographer, I documented the coastline intensely up and down between Newborough and Peterhead. And I started talking about my own journey and just anything that I could think of to speak about that might be interesting enough to people who were shielding or on a lockdown.
So it was for broadcast?
So actually I got interviewed by the news, STV News, about that, because they'd heard that it had filtered out into different countries, not extensively, but it had ventured far. So I was quite pleased with that. So that was 2020. That gave me a step up, because especially when I could see that the news, the reporter was interested in it. And I think that gave me the confidence to go forward, especially after lockdown. And I thought, that's my pitch. I need to get going now, because everybody had been locked up. And, you know, I had been in shielding longer than most people because of my partner's condition. So I felt a wee bitty out in the loop of everything, and it was important for me to catch up.
Right, okay, that's interesting. I'm just trying to think of the videos you've given us. Am I right in thinking that, because I was looking at the catalogue this morning, am I right in thinking that a few were done in 2019 before the pandemic?
Yeah.
So, and they were with individuals, were they?
Yeah, that, I can't remember just entirely what that material was, Nick.
Well, we can have a look at it later if you want. But it was just, I think it was just interviews with people. I think you interviewed a young person about their enthusiasm for Doric and things like that. But I'm not sure if I'm getting the dates muddled up. Was that pre-lockdown or?
I think I did do some videoing pre the pandemic, but not to the extent that I did after the pandemic. But I've done so many videos, Nick, I can't remember what I did when.
I know the feeling, yeah. So I mean, it sounds like largely you were doing this very reflective thing where you were talking about your own connections to the area and filming yourself, I suppose, in the coastline and talking about it. How did people feel when you took the video camera and stopped pointing it at yourself and started pointing it at them? Were they receptive? Were some people a bit wary?
No, I think they were very receptive, Nick. I mean, I never came across anybody who shied away from the video camera. And I think it's simply because it's a phone. It's an iPhone. It's not a big... I'm not a TV company coming along with sound people. I'm an individual who they know, and they can probably relate to quite quickly because I speak the same language. So they felt at ease with me. Probably, I think that's what it was, mostly, Nick, is they felt at ease with me very quickly. So they were quite open to being videoed.
Right, okay. That makes all the difference sometimes, doesn't it? That human connection to people. Were you quite transparent about what your goals were? I mean, I guess you had your website and the YouTube channel and everything like that. Were you always videoing with the purposes, with the goals of putting it online? Or was there something else there? Was there another reason for it?
I think the thing that I put forward most of all is that I'd hoped, which it is now, is the case, that it would be archived and it would be there for future reference. And if somebody needed to do it, somebody needed to, in the area, the local area, needed to do it, especially in Cruden Bay area, because there isn't a lot of that, there isn't a lot of filming going on along in the Cruden Bay area. So I did highlight that my aim was that it would be archived, which it is now, thanks to Nick.
And how did you, I mean, obviously, you know, Cruden Bay is not huge. I mean, I guess for context, how many people would you say are in Cruden Bay, roughly?
I'm not sure of the population.
It's not massive.
It's not massive, no. It's small.
Yeah, maybe, 1,000?
More than that, probably. Maybe
3,000, okay.
Yeah.
It's big enough so that there's a wide variety of people, but not big enough so that you would probably recognize most of the people there, I guess. So I'm curious how you found contributors, right? Because you can only interview one person at a time. So how did you make up a list of people that you were really keen to interview? Did you just bump into people and say, listen, would you like to be interviewed? How did you sort of arrange all that?
Well, I think it was a bit like the law of attraction, Nick. When you're so focused on something and so enthusiastic, you just about trip over it. And that's what I found, that I really didn't have any plan of who I was going to video next, because that person just somehow, I came across them and I contacted them and told them what I was about, and they said, oh, that's fine. So a lot of the time I just grasped material as I was out and about, so it wasn't planned. So it just shows that I didn't have any, there was no team behind me, Nick, so I could do what I want basically and ask who I want.
Did anybody come up to you without being sort of asked to?
No.
They write to you and say, oh, I really want to be filmed or something like that?
No, nobody came forward willingly.
Okay, that's quite interesting. So I'm trying to think, so this was really picked up after lockdown, when everybody was able to start moving about again and everything like that. How long did it last?
A few years, Nick, until I think the problem with Doric Future and the project was being a single person trying to run our own show. There's two things. I probably run out of people to interview, credible people to interview. I think that was my big stumbling block. And also my my lack of technical ability. I was just exhausted trying to work out how to, you know, fathom out Facebook, Instagram and all this sort of thing. And I think that's why I became a cropper, is I tried to do too much. If I kept it simple, it might have still been going yet, Nick.
I mean, it's amazing what you have done. And yeah, I think we all know how exhausting that kind of work can be. So it's astonishing. How many roughly videos do you think you ended up doing during the pandemic? Do you remember? Or, well, after...
In total, I think there's over 200. Is there 200 to 300, Nick?
I was just trying to remember that. And it would be roughly around that anyway.
Uh-huh.
Maybe a wee bit under 200. But uh-huh. At least what I have, and that's maybe one of the things we need to double check.
Yeah.
But I think it's around that, which is a huge amount. And I mean, did you have a sort of a set length for interviews in mind? Like you wanted to keep it focused for a 10-minute video, or did you have some really long chats?
I think that was one of my downfalls, is that I probably over-videoed. I over-interviewed and didn't keep it to like a 10-minute production, I should say, for YouTube. And I think that's where, you know, a lot of my videos kind of were overlooked because they were too long. Looking back on it, in hindsight, it's a great thing. But I was so enthused. When I start to speak to somebody, Nick, I just get so carried away. And I ask them question upon question until we both think that's enough. 1 hour down the line.
I mean, that's interesting that you're sort of taking into consideration things like YouTube algorithms and things, because I know it probably doesn't share it as much when they're longer. And
yeah.
It depends on the thumbnail and all these complicated things like that. I mean, from my perspective, it's great that you had some longer interviews because it gives people really a chance to get into things in a little bit more depth. And you might not get as many listeners or as many viewers, but the people who are listening are really interested and can maybe get a lot more out of it than they would from, you know, these sorts of TikTok videos that you get nowadays, which are quite short and condensed. So it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it ends up maybe working in a slightly different way, I guess. So you know that I work at the Alfonsen Institute. You know what the Alfonsen Institute's work is generally about. And you know that I'm an archivist and I do field work with people and other things. But there's also there's a lot of people like you, Jill, who do amazing work in their communities. And they might be called community archivists sometimes, community field workers, community ethnographers, or community documentarians, or something like that. And I guess, is that a term, or any of those terms that make sense to you, that you would ever use?
Probably not, Nick, because I never saw myself as any of these. I just saw somebody as a plain old person who was just going about our business and thinking, well, wait a minute, there's somebody very interesting there. That needs to be captured. There's a very interesting scene there. That needs to be captured. So I never really saw myself as any of these, Nick. I just love doing it.
That's interesting. But I mean, I guess to my mind, the thing is, nobody else has done it, right, in Cruden Bay. So what was it about you, Jill, that you think made it that you were the person who went out and did all this work?
I don't know, Nick. I had the drive to do it. I'm not really passionate about a lot of things, but that was one thing that I really was passionate about, Nick. So it was the drive. You need drive. You need passion and you need drive. You couldn't do it without these two things.
Okay, that's fair enough. I mean, you have touched on this, but maybe I'll just kind of rephrase it in a sense and maybe unpack it a wee bit. What's the importance of documenting community or a community, a specific place? Why do you think that's important? Because you're not just, you know, some people might focus on, let's say, I don't know, all the fishermen, and just make all their work about the fishermen or something like that, or all their work about ministers or something. But you have seemingly gone around and asked all different kinds of people from all different walks of life. Why is that an important way of doing it, do you think?
Well, I think it's people need to be highlighted, Nick. In their lifetime, they need to be highlighted by some means. And I just think that what I did was to highlight people, to highlight places. Like my late dad, he was a farmer, as I said that earlier. And I, maybe an occasion I would have said to him, well, you know what you've done, Dad? And he would hang his head doing like that, Nick. And he wouldn't acknowledge what he did. He wouldn't acknowledge the contribution that he'd made to the land. And it's people like my dad that I did it for. It was people like my dad that I did it for. And I highlight that, Nick, because I know that I've come from a very humble background, very hardworking background, people who really didn't acknowledge themselves or their contribution. And probably they weren't acknowledged either, very much. And I think that was probably where it's come from, I would say, Nick.
Okay, that's really, really fascinating. I'm just having a wee look here, so don't mind me, but and make sure to drink some of your coffee so you're not too thirsty. I guess you've touched on this too, but were there any things that you said when you're kind of starting on a project like this, were there any specific people, or, I mean, you don't have to name names, but were there specific people or specific topics that you thought to yourself, I need to document that? If nothing else, those are the things I need to get on film.
Well, I needed to get people of higher profile who were interested or who had connections with the Doric. So I got a hold of, I don't know how I got a hold of her, but I did, Dame Evelyn Glennie. And I interviewed her through, means of interviewing people through a device from a distance.
Oh, like Zoom.
Zoom, yes. Yeah, yeah. I interviewed her through Zoom, and I was just so fascinated at how she could read my lips through a device. That was incredible. But she come, like myself, is from farming background, and I knew that she was somebody who still promotes and loves to promote the Doric, even though she's now an international star, and she lives down south. And she was very, very interested in what I was doing, Nick, and I knew that somebody like that would, who spoke at length, would go far. Yeah.
So yes, why was it important to get high profile people? What's the thinking behind that? Because I mean, yeah, I guess you were telling me about highlighting all the different people who maybe wouldn't highlight themselves, but then on the other hand, you've got,
yeah, from the other scale. Yeah, I just felt that we needed somebody to recognizable who was going to shout for us, and that exactly what she did. And also Iona Fife, I did interviewed her through Zoom, and through her music, she loves to present the Doric. And I just thought that it was important that we got these more people who are a bit more known, and you know, to be able to shout for us, Nick.
And did that help the project? Did it get views? And more,
I think, profile? So. I think so, Nick. Because how does a wifey for Crudenby get to interview these people, Nick?
Yeah, that's quite interesting. I mean, you said earlier that STV had come to interview you pretty early on. I know that sometimes like the media can sort of pop in and then disappear, and maybe they sort of think we've done that before, but do they ever come back? Did they recover that story and see how it had developed at all, or was it a one-off?
The TV didn't come back, but there was a television company from the islands. What do you call it, Nick?
Oh, BBC Alba?
Alba. Uh-huh. They came to Cruden Bay, and they were interested to get a hold of, from a local perspective, what this area was about. So we got a Gaelic-speaking interviewer, which was very nice, and he interviewed me, and he took that back to Alba TV, which was good, because I thought that was really important that we are seen by different areas and different cultures of the country. So I thought that was a good connection. The newspapers were very interested, Nick, in the project, and there was many press releases. Mostly I wrote them myself But that's the best way to do it, Nick, because that's the way you can get the proper information to the newspapers. So it was highlighted in the newspaper, I must admit, yes.
So how does that work? Because, I mean, even at the university context, I know it's a little bit complicated. If we've got some project we want to raise the profile of, we have to send an email to the sort of marketing people or whatever and say, can you put out a press release and rewrite it? And then they inevitably rewrite it. And then some version of it makes its way to the paper, and then the paper takes it and adapts it however they want. How does an individual like you you write a press release, and what did you do? You just emailed it to the newspapers, or how did that work in practice?
Connection. If you've got a connection in the local press, Nick, that makes a lot of difference. And if they begin to know you and what you're about, they'll take your story without any question. And that's what happened. And I poured over days and days in writing my my article to make sure that I got it right, and to get sure that I put across what I wanted to put across, so it would be received in that sort of manner. And I think it was always very upbeat. Yeah.
So those local connections are really key.
Local, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. You're just one person, Chell. And when I look at the amount you did in the relatively short amount of time, I always just wonder, how did you find the time?
I don't know. I think when you're enthusiastic about something, Nick, you put a lot aside to do the work. And it's easy, so you don't really think it is time. I didn't think it is time. I just saw it interviewing people. It was a pleasure to me, and time really didn't come into it.
Can you get into the process a wee bit? So let's imagine it's 2021, lockdown is finished, pandemic's still sort of about, it's a day when you're doing an interview. How does that work in practice?
Well, you've just got to work around it, Nick. You've got to do all your chores and look after your those who need look after, and Nick, and then think, right, okay, I've got a window. And I used to run, Nick, literally run, because to try to pack everything in. And it was a bit rushed at times, I must admit. It was a bit rushed. And yes, I was tired after it, because I was doing so much at one time. I was tired when I came to the end of an interview, because I put so much into it, Nick. And I just wanted to get out, to try to get the person I was being interviewed. I wanted to get out as much of them as I could at the time, because I knew that I wouldn't be able to maybe see them again. So it was, although I say time just didn't seem important, it took out quite a bit of my neck, because just the amount of energy and probably time that I put into it.
Yeah, and once you finished an interview, say, whether you were sort of rushed or not, what did you do then? How did you deal with the video itself?
Well, I tried to edit it as quickly as possible. Obviously, I didn't want videos piling up. So I tried to edit it as quickly as I could. And then put it up on my YouTube channel, and then I passed it on to my friend and crew May to put it onto the website, the Direct Future website.
Right, so you were putting things onto YouTube, and at the same time they were going up on the website?
Yeah.
The same video, not like different versions? All right, okay. I don't think I realized to what extent you were editing the videos. It's been a while since I've watched one of the videos in full, because obviously I've been busy, and we were involved in this over the summer last year when you were cataloguing all these videos. But how long did it take to edit them? Is that something that you could do quite easily? And how did you edit them?
Well, I was quite lucky, Nick, because everybody I spoke to, you know, there wasn't a lot of editing needed, Nick. I probably, looking at it in hindsight, I should have tried to cut them down, but that's difficult. If you try to cut down a 30-minute interview to 10 minutes, that's difficult, because what do you cut out? Where do you cut it out? So, I mean, I just let it run with what people were saying, basically. It was more the getting onto YouTube.
Yeah, because I guess you have to sort of put your... there was a sort of an introduction.
Yeah.
Like, whatever you call that. A sting or something like that with a 20 seconds of an opening and a closing, maybe something like that. You kind of topped and tailed the videos, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's quite interesting. And Jill, you just let me know at any time if you think I've had enough, or if you need a break or anything like that, or if you want to continue this another day. Okay, don't hesitate. And I realize you've got a view out the window here, so I don't know how bright it is for you, but
it's okay.
You kind of mentioned this a bit about with the person who was helping you, said a chap in the village, I think. But yeah, how did that work? How did you meet this person, and how did you get them? How did you convince them to help you?
Well, actually, it was his idea that I started a platform. I needed somebody to give me a bit of a push, and he said to me, "Jill, what about our Drodic? What about our Drodic? How does it lie today? How is it going to lie in the future if we're not going to try to promote it today?" And I thought that's something that we could run with. So then he started the Drodic Future website, and in tangent we did the Drodic Future YouTube channel. But the way that we communicated, believe this or not, Nick, was by email. So therefore, can you imagine how alone and isolated I was in the work that I did? The one person that was supporting me, I emailed and I asked questions. It wasn't easy. No, it wasn't easy.
And that was somebody local, though.
That was somebody local.
Yeah.
Somebody local.
Okay, that's interesting. So you were actually having conversations with other people in the area about the project and sort of thinking it through with them, as opposed to just trying to take everything 100% on board yourself. Is that fair?
Yeah, I was trying to enthuse the idea, but at the same token, I was trying to get, instead of me always going out there trying to get people to interview, I was trying to say I need sort of help and support to help me, like a team, but that unfortunately that team never came, Nick. So I think that's one of the reasons, and the reason that it kind of it dried up at the end of the day. I was so tired myself. And when you get to that stage, you just have to stop, because the enthusiasm kind of is not the same as it was before.
Yeah, well, that's understandable, and like I said, it's astonishing the amount of things that you did get done. Sorry, I'm just having a wee look through these again. You've given us all these videos. You've sent them all to us. You've catalogued them now, which is amazing. I still can't believe you actually came in and catalogued them. I think that's pretty rare when people send us videos or things like that, or donate materials to us, to actually catalogue it. It's such a help. And I guess my question is, you mentioned that your end goal was to put it in an archives. Why did you choose the Elphinstone Institute archives, and how do you know about the Institute? How long have you known about the Institute?
Well, I've known about yourself for a while, Nick, because I've always wanting to be able to connect with yourself. And I thought, well, what better way to connect than to present my videos so that they can be archived through Elphinstone? And it's the only big organisation in the Northeast that would have been for me to be able to pass on my videos to.
And what are your hopes in giving this collection to us? What are your hopes for us in terms of how we use that material?
Well, if you can use it and extensively as you wish, Nick, in any form or manner that you wish, I'll be delighted, because that's one of the reasons that I was videoing for.
Okay, all right. You mentioned that you did photography and things like that, and it just seems to me like, despite the fact that you said you're not passionate about too many things, it sounds like you are quite passionate actually about at least some specific things. And did you ever express these passions in other ways? So I know you've done the photography and you did the videos. Did you ever do anything else, like write anything or do anything else along those lines?
I'm not a writer, Nick. I can write a report or an article to the newspaper, but I'm not a writer. I'd love to be able to write. But no, that was one thing. And music, I would have loved to have done, been involved in the music scene, but I'm not musical, Nick. So these are just through images and through meeting people, Nick. That's about the only two things, the avenues.
And is there anything in particular that you want to highlight about the collection, or any particular memories you have of creating it?
Well, I just think it's so extensive, and it varies such a lot. From I can think of the variation between Derek Dad, who's on TikTok, to Gordon Hay, who wrote who translated the Doric into the New and the Old and New Testament. I mean, that's the variation of people, and that's what makes us unique, that we've got these kind of people. So I think that just the variation of people that I was able to interview, Nick, was just amazing. Yeah.
So you called the project Doric Futures, and I had in mind also that there was Doric TV at one point.
Yeah.
Can you tell me what the difference is between those two, or if they're connected in some way?
Well, Doric Future was the original project, and then when we could see that it was becoming more extensive and more popular, I tried to get a handle, and I thought Doric TV. We've got Alba TV, but what kind of TV have we got for the Northeast, Nick? We ain't got no TV. So I thought, okay, we need to, it was just a handle, Nick, that was used to try to catch people's attention.
So the key word in there, obviously, is Doric.
Yes.
It's not geographical. It's not Northeast TV or something like that. It's Doric TV, which is obviously referring to, you know, to the language.
Yeah.
And when you were interviewing people and speaking to people, was it important to you that they be Doric speakers?
Not always, Nick, because I must admit I've sometimes struggled to get a real proper Doric speakers. But what I really wanted to do was to get represented today of how we are today, how we've come on today, what we sound like today, and then people in the future will be able to look back and think, well, that's how they sounded in the year, whatever. I would have liked to have been a bit like Jim Taylor and the videos that he had of all the Doric speaking people. I would have loved to be in that era, that he was able to grasp that, but unfortunately haven't been able to grasp as many Doric speaking people as I'd have liked. Some, but not as many as I'd have liked to, Nick.
Is that because you think there's fewer Doric speakers now?
Oh, definitely. There's no doubt about it, Nick. I mean, when I was born and brought up on a farm, we spoke Doric all the time. As you can hear, there's very little words that I remember, Nick, and I couldn't string Doric words together. But when I was younger, I was able to string all the words together, and there was a language, and that's gone. It's gone for me. It's gone for my son. Doesn't speak Doric at all, so I think that's the problem that we have nowadays, Nick.
Sometimes when you speak a language when you're growing up, when you hear that language later on, or when you're speaking with somebody who speaks that language, it sort of comes back in a way. And I wonder, when you were filming with the people you sort of considered to be really Doric speakers, did you notice that the way you were speaking to them was different from the way you might speak to somebody like me who doesn't speak Doric?
Yeah, you could lapse back, because you would somehow would just spark something in your memory that you thought you'd forgotten about, and actually you hadn't. It was there all the time. And I used to love to speak. I loved to speak to pure Doric speakers, because then it encouraged me to come up with words and to use the dialect as I did when I was younger.
Oh, that's interesting. You've kind of described how exhausting it was to do the project, and by the end of it, maybe you'd run out of steam a wee bit, I guess, is one way of putting it. Is there any hope for the future? Do you have any interest in doing something like this again, do you think? Or is there somebody you might think you could sort of pass the mantle on to, in a sense?
Well, I haven't got anybody, Nick, as yet, to pass the project or the Doric Future the YouTube channel onto. That's why I'm glad that I've been able to get it archived with yourselves, Nick. I've no plans to video at the moment because I don't have an, I don't have a project in mind, and I'm very much project based, Nick. My partner has got a serious health condition, and I've got to put that foremost. So that is another factor into it as well.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fair enough, and that makes good sense. I guess that's I mean, that's a lot already. Actually, you've told me so much, Jill, and that really helps me understand your collection more. Obviously, I'd spoken to you before. We spoke a few times over the phone during the pandemic, I remember, and then obviously we met, and you gave the collection to us, and you came and catalogued it. But just having a chat with you helps me understand the motivations behind the collections a lot better, and why it's so important to you. And I guess I'm curious to know if there's anything else you want to tell me, or you want to tell anybody who, in terms of more context for the collections.
I don't think so, Nick. I think I covered everything. I think it kind of grew arms and legs, Nick, because there was something I started to do, which I didn't intend to do, but it just happened gradually. I do a bit of cycling, not serious cycling, but I toodle about in my bicycle, my bike, with my partner, and we walk quite a bit. And what we did was we started to present walking and cycling for good mental and physical well-being. And I think that's where somebody that's got ideas and just channels their energy into producing what comes of that idea. And I think that was the kind of the thing that I liked about Doric TV. It could twist and turns. Twists and turns. So never say never, Jill, because one never knows what's around the corner.
That's fair enough. One last cheeky question then. Obviously, you were filming yourself at one point, walking along the coastline, like you said, and you were filming other people. Today, somebody has taken a microphone and put it in front of you for a change. How does that feel?
It feels strange, because I'm not usually one that... I can speak about it because I've got a passion for it, but normally I wouldn't be able to speak much at all, Nick. No, I don't like to be formally interviewed. It's only because I love what I did. But the reason that is, Nick, is because of the people that I met and the scenes that I come across. And that's what made it.
Okay, well, that's brilliant, and that is so helpful, and very kind of you to come in and speak with me today, Jill. So if it's okay with you, I'll just end it there. Is that all right? Okay.